It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning.
No job. He's traveling. He's down in Arizona.
Arizona, apparently. Having his papers checked. So we'll see if he makes it back. All right. We are covering plenty to cover this week, starting out with local and an Evergreen State student getting a judgment.
Yes,
in his favor.
Philip Chin, an Evergreen State student, won a $169,000 settlement from the State Patrol this week. State Patrol, the City of Aberdeen and Grays Harbor County. Apparently, Chin and a couple of friends were on their way to a protest, one of the port protests in Grays Harbor, the port of Aberdeen, in May of 2007. And it turned out that cops were not only tracking their movements and spying on them, but they were also communicating information and receiving information from the military on who was joining and participating in the port protests. And they targeted Chin and his friends for arrest. They pulled Chin over on the excuse that they thought he was intoxicated. He passed a field sobriety test. He submitted to a blood test, and yet they arrested him anyway on the suspicion that he was intoxicated. The arresting officer said that the reason he arrested Chin was because he had bumps and a white coating on his tongue. That was the reason. Chin, it turned out, of course, from the blood test, was not intoxicated. He had not been drinking anything. And then it came out in court that the State Patrol and other law enforcement had been spying on protesters, tracking them and trying to keep them from joining the protest, which of course is a violation of their constitutional rights. So Chin won his settlement from the State Patrol in the City of Aberdeen and Grays Harbor County, and he also they also committed to paying his lawyer's fees too. The ACLU helped him with that case. Clearly, too, because the military had been involved with passing information to the law enforcement agencies, the ACLU believes this was a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, which if folks who aren't familiar with that should know that the Posse Comitatus Act prevents the military from doing any kind of law enforcement, any kind of spying or deploying within the boundaries of the United States.
And that's all actually ties back into something we had covered via Democracy Now!, which was that same group that was organized in those demonstrations was infiltrated by a member of the Army who had come to numerous meetings.
The ACLU is also looking into that case as well, that a group of Olympia activists who were involved in the port protests claim that there was a member of the military working undercover trying to infiltrate their group, and they actually have the guy's name and they know who he is. And so that's another case that's working its way through the courts.
Right.
Now.
And this also ties into these new fusion centers, which are popping up across the country.
Right, right. And, you know, one of the things, too, that came out with this case was that the military had set up some kind of an action plan with local law enforcement groups for how to deal with the protesters and ways to keep them from, you know, reaching the protests and organizing and all that kind of stuff. So not only a violation of their constitutional rights, but, you know, direct interference by the military.
And then there's the bumps and the white coating on the tongue. Is that supposedly standard for alcohol consumption?
No.
Because I don't see that when they pan people at, like, the Super Bowl.
Right.
Know?
No.
All right.
It's not.
I don't know where that came from. Uh-huh. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. We'll move on to something that just took over the national media for the duration of the week and pushed the oil spill out of there for a while was the Times Square bomber.
Yeah, the idiot car bomber. I call him the idiot car bomber because when they described the device that was meant to explode, you know, fertilizer that's non-explosive, you know, and here I'm just going to read you a sentence from a New York Times article, quote, "The detonation device, it was believed that the timers would ignite the can of explosives, and that would cause the 5-gallon cans to go on fire, and then explode the propane tanks and have some effect on that rifle box. So you're looking, you're thinking about this, you're going, okay, this was like some kind of a weird Rube Goldberg device. You know, there were timers on one end, and there were some firecrackers somewhere else, and there was, you know, some M80 someplace else, and then there was cans of gas, and there were a couple propane tanks, and then there was this rifle box full of non-explosive fertilizer. It's like, okay, you know, it's like he threw everything in the kitchen sink in there to try to come up with something that might work, and of course it didn't.
My first thought when I read the different things that were in the car was actually, it sounds like one of my relatives' barbecues.
I know. Aside from that, of course, it could have exploded and injured people on the sidewalk nearby. That, too, is a serious issue. And so, of course, you know, this is a problem. My first thought, too, was that, you know, this sounds like some kind of a domestic terrorism thing, too, because the use of a car bomb we've seen before in places like Oklahoma City. That, of course, was a truck bomb, and that was explosive fertilizer, and it was very, very damaging. So my first thought was, I wonder if this was a domestic terrorist. But domestic terrorists, on the other hand, tend to have some military training and know what they're doing, and their attacks tend to be far more deadly. On the other hand, we heard this week, too, about the group in, I believe it was Minnesota, the group of militia members who had planned attacks against law enforcement personnel. Those folks who had been busted by the FBI and arrested, they, of course, did have some military training, some of them. And they had credible plans for killing people. Those folks were released on bail this week. They were not, you didn't hear calls like you did this week of people saying that the idiot car bomber should be, have his U.S. citizenship rights stripped away from him. He should disappear into Guantanamo. You know, people saying that, it's a problem that they read him his Miranda rights, you know, things like that. They didn't say that about the militia members who were released on bail this week. Even though I think if you compare the two, that the militia members were a far more dangerous force than this idiot who didn't really know what he was doing. But aside from that, let's look at who this guy was. A lot of what we heard in the media about him is, oh, you know, he trained in Pakistan with the Pakistani Taliban, and that the Pakistani government is going after the Pakistani Taliban, and this was their attempt at revenge. I don't think that was strictly true. He himself claims that he trained in North Waziristan with Taliban. However, if you look at the composition of the Taliban in Pakistan, in North Waziristan, that's where you have the Afghani Taliban. The guys that were fighting in Afghanistan have their base in North Waziristan. Also, the Pakistani Taliban is not a homogenous group. It's made up of a number of different tribes in the Waziristan region. The Pakistani government is going after the tribe that inhabits most of South Waziristan, and not touching the tribe that is inhabiting North Waziristan. And in fact, the Pakistani military, the U.S. military and the U.S. CIA often admit that there are direct links between the Pakistani military and members of the Taliban, particularly the Taliban that inhabits North Waziristan. So you look at this guy. His father is a Pakistani military officer. He traveled to North Waziristan, you know, and he got his training there and his religious training as well. And he came back to the U.S. and he perpetrated an attack on U.S. soil. So my question is, now that the big issue that they're trying to, that the U.S. Intelligence agencies are trying to handle is, where did the guy get the money? My question is, was some of that money U.S. taxpayer money? Because we have funneled millions, if not billions of dollars to the Pakistani government in order to, and it's gone directly into the pockets of the Pakistani military in order to supposedly pursue the Pakistani Taliban. They've pursued some of the Pakistani Taliban. We don't know where the rest of the money has gone. So my question is some of the money that financed this attack, did it come directly out of U.S. taxpayers' pockets? And I think you could make an argument for that. But, of course, that's not something you're going to read about in the New York Times or hear about on the nightly news.
No. All right, let's move on to talk about what was displaced by all that coverage, further coverage on the oil spill.
Yeah, there are a lot of disturbing things that we're finding out now about the oil spill. But, again, things that we're not hearing about on the nightly news. One of them is that it turns out that BP may have been drilling deeper than their federal permit allowed. The federal permit allowed them to drill as far as 18 to 20,000 feet. Some of the personnel that were evacuated from the rig claimed that BP had been drilling 22,000 feet deep and perhaps deeper, and that they didn't. Because they had exceeded the depth on their permit, they didn't communicate this to Halliburton. That's what some of these employees are saying. Halliburton was responsible for putting down the concrete seal that was supposed to close off the well until they could get a production rig over it to start producing oil. Well, the concrete seal is a very, very tricky process, and if you don't know the exact depth and you don't know the exact diameter of the well and the pressure and all that sort of thing that's involved with you know, the exact dimensions and everything and how far you're supposed to be pumping it in and how much, then if you get an incomplete seal, you get leaks, and leaks can cause explosions. And it seemed pretty clear to the workers on site that the problem was a natural gas or methane leak of some kind that led to the explosion. And since it happened almost directly after they had sealed the well, then they're starting to come up with these questions of, okay, what went wrong? In addition, I think you mentioned, Mike, too, before we went on the air, that it turned out that night when the explosion occurred, they had a whole bunch of personnel on board, a bunch of executives on board. They were celebrating
BP.
Right. They were celebrating BP's safety record on that night. And on that particular rig.
Things going great.
Yeah, things are going so well. You guys have been so productive. You're ahead of schedule. They'd been rushing to complete the job early because, of course, the workers are given a bonus if they complete the job early. So there were a bunch of things going on that night. Also, it turns out that in order to save money, BP didn't install a deep water valve 200 feet below the seafloor, which would have kicked in once the other valves failed, and that could have prevented the oil spill from happening altogether. But, you know, yet more of BP's cost cutting there. And another thing that we're hearing, too, is that in order to save costs, BP didn't have the requisite number of they just weren't prepared for the cleanup. They didn't have the number of booms that they needed. They didn't have the number of trained cleanup crews available. They don't have the ships that they needed to get out there in order to contain and deal with an oil spill of this size. Of course, saving money means that you make more profit, but when disaster hits, it also means that the environment suffers.
Which was actually true of their involvement with the Exxon Valdez, even though it was an Exxon Valdez ship that ran aground. BP was the one that was in charge of cleanup and prepping the cleanup crews for that area up in Alaska.
And they claimed that they had cleanup crews available that actually were not available. So a little bit of PR there instead of reality going on in order to continue to operate, in order to win federal leases, but not necessarily operate in the way that you're supposed to do if you're going to be drilling these deep water wells. Also, what I've been hearing too, we've been hearing in the media every time I read an article or hear a report on the oil spill, is that they're pouring chemical dispersants on the oil. And of course, that sets up a red flag in my mind what the heck are these chemical dispersants? And, you know, I know the oil is going to have a bad impact on the environment. What about these chemicals? Well, you know, you're right. If you're like me and that sets up a red flag in your brain, you're right to worry about that because most of these chemical dispersants are not, they're of unknown composition. We don't know what is in them because the companies that make them, it's a proprietary trade secret. They don't want anyone to know what they put in their chemical dispersants. So, of course, we don't know what chemicals are being pumped into the oil spill. also, with this oil spill, there's been some 160,000 gallons of chemical dispersant, which is far beyond what anyone has ever put on an oil spill in the past. In fact, it's such a large amount that it exceeds the total amount of chemical dispersant that the country of Norway has in reserve for the use in cleaning up oil spills in the North Sea. I mean, it's a huge amount of chemicals being poured into this thing. Typically, what chemical dispersants do is they bind with the oil, make the oil clump into little droplets that are heavier than the water, and the droplets sink to the ocean floor. That in itself is not without an environmental impact. You know, there's a whole ecology on the ocean floor that is very important. And in addition, the chemical dispersants that don't bind with the oil continue on in the environment. They don't just go away. You know, and they don't deteriorate as quickly as you might assume. The idea is if you use chemical dispersants on a small spill in a large body of water, that the ocean currents will break up the chemical dispersants. They'll dilute them and eventually, you know, make it so that the chemicals in such a small diluted form will not have an impact on marine life. However, when you've got such a high volume of chemical dispersant in an area and such a large spill, you know, that's not going to happen, right? At least not immediately. You know, those chemicals will stay there for a while, and the dilution process will not be rapid enough to avoid some kind of impact on the marine life in the Gulf area. We can talk a little bit, too, about what is going on in terms of the marine life in the Gulf area. I mean, this is spring. Spring is the season where you have, you know, reproduction going on amongst almost all of the species that inhabit the Gulf waters. And, that's a lot of different species. Right now you have fish eggs. Most of the different species of fish in the Gulf right now, their fish eggs are floating around on the surface of the water. Well, you know, what else is floating around on the surface of the water out there is this enormous oil spill. And, that means you could see a whole, you know, you could see whole fish runs disappear, literally, at this point. You have billions of tiny blue crabs floating around on the current out there. You have the larvae of different species floating around on the currents out there right now. Those are all going to be impacted by the oil spill and the chemical dispersants used to try to break it up so that the oil doesn't become as visible on the surface, but is still out there. And then, of course, there are the larger species, the turtles, the dolphins, whales, manatees, countless other types of species that are going to be affected by the spill as well.
Yeah, sucking up that oil and chemicals.
Mm-hmm, and the fumes, yeah. Too.
All right, let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, and economic news this week, one of the big headlines was were the riots in Greece. I just want to talk for a bit about what led up to them. The IMF and the European Union announced a bailout for Greece of $143 billion. That comes to about a third of Greece's outstanding debt. In addition, but they said that in order for Greece to get this bailout money, they had to pass austerity measures. That's, you know, typical IMF policy. And of course, the austerity measures involved cuts and then freezes in pensions for Greek government workers. Also, freezes in wages and the abolishment of bonuses for most government employees. Well, all government employees, really. And, what's interesting about these austerity measures is that they will only save the Greek budget about $38 billion over the next 2 to 3 years. That's not nearly enough. As I said, the bailout is about a third of Greece's outstanding debt. So the question then arises, is Greece going to have to come back for more money, or are they going to have to, you know, lay people off or do even deeper cuts? In addition, there's a question of, you know, when you cut government spending during an economic downturn, you can plunge a country into a very deep recession. And that's the major worry here in Greece. How will the government ever bail themselves out if tax revenue falls steeply because the country is in a very deep recession? Economists have pointed out, several economists have pointed out that what Greece is being forced to do is exactly what the IMF forced Latin America to do in the 1980s, and it led literally to a lost decade where, you know, wages stagnated, the economies plunged. You know, there was no progress for any Latin American economies during that time. So, you know, it set off not just the riots in Greece, but also set off some major wild swings in the stock market here. Thursday, one of the big news on Thursday and Friday was what everyone thought was a trading error caused a huge plunge in stock markets here in the U.S. At first, everybody said, well, you know, there must have been some kind of an erroneous error, what they call a fat finger mistake, when somebody adds extra zeros onto a trade, onto a sell trade, which then set the stock market plunging because it cued computer programs. Get this, it cued computer trading systems to trigger their automatic sells. So when the price of certain stock falls below a certain level, you know, there are automated trades set that when that price falls to a certain level, you better sell. And so it's triggered this massive sell-off, automatic sell-off by automated computer trades. But I think that's an excuse, really. You know, now that they're investigating it, they're finding, well, that really wasn't the cause. They can't find the smoking gun trade. It wasn't some guy's mistake where he added some extra zeros. You know, they're not finding that. What they're finding is that it's a systemic problem combined with the fact that people are selling stock and the stock markets are plunging, primarily because of the problems in Greece and the debt problems that are spreading to other countries in the European Union as well. So, you know, before the system took its 10-minute plunge on Thursday, the markets were already headed down and people were worried about what was going on in Greece. People were selling stock. People creditors were trying to get out of Greek bonds, they were also trying to get out of, you know, other government bonds in Europe. They were looking for safe haven for their money. You know, money was moving around at lightning speed. In addition, you have these automated trades set in that, can get the market running in one direction and no one able to stop it for a while. So that's what happened, really. They're saying now that they will probably never figure out what the cause is. That in itself is a problem, the fact that they will never figure out the cause and that nobody totally understands how the system works or how it operates. You would think there would be some regulator out there who at least knows how the system works. No, you would be wrong. And that in itself is a problem.
All right. How about an update on what's happening with Fannie and Freddie?
Oh, yeah. And this week, sort of behind the headlines, driven out of the headlines by the plunge in the stock market, Freddie Mac came to the U.S. government and said, well, we had such a terrible first quarter. We need more money. So the U.S. government is approving another $10.6 billion for Freddie Mac. That means that the total bailout money for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has come to about $136.5 billion, which is, if you think about it, is in the realm of the bailout for Greece, for the whole government of Greece. You know, I know we've been hearing a lot about how, well, the bailout was successful and, you know, Timothy Geithner's been bragging about how all these companies we bailed out are paying back their loans. You know, the U.S. taxpayers may make a profit or in the end, at the most, they will have spent a few billion dollars on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, that few billion dollars spent on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is actually a pretty big sum of money and it will never be repaid. It is, in effect, how U.S. taxpayers are propping up the housing market. We're doing that in several ways. One of the ways is we're pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's not going to end anytime soon. You know, they're not going to suddenly have an upturn in their finances in the second quarter or the third quarter or the fourth quarter. They're going to keep coming back quarter after quarter for more money. That's one way we're propping up the housing market. The other way that we're doing it is we're extending these tax breaks to home buyers through these home buyer credits that essentially robs the U.S. Treasury of money. And what we're finding now with audits of these tax credits is that a lot of people are taking them who don't qualify. So that's money out of the taxpayers' pocket into the pockets of individuals around the country to try to get them to buy houses, to prop up housing prices, and to prop up the interest rates for mortgages. In addition, another way that we're propping up the housing market and that we're propping up banks and bailing out banks that is kind of a hidden cost that U.S. taxpayers don't see is the 0% interest rates for banks to borrow from each other and from the federal government. These banks literally get free money. They're getting free money to turn around to loan to you and I at rates of, what is it? I think the average credit card rate is 14%. That's a pretty decent dang profit if you get that money for free and you can loan it back out at 14%. Who would say no to that? You know, that is a direct bailout to banks at the expense of people who save money. I don't know if you have a savings account and you opened the state or a money market fund and you opened your statement lately and you saw that you were paid pennies for your savings in the first quarter. You know, you're not making any interest on your savings at all. Banks don't have to pay you anything to have your money. And they turn around, they loan it out for high interest rates like that. You have a question, Mike?
Well, and that's from when you say they're getting it at 0%, they're getting it from the government at 0%?
Oh, yeah.
From each
yeah.
other?
Yeah, they're getting it from
so
each other.
So why not just cut them out and, you know, give us the...
And they're getting it from you for almost nothing. Like I was saying, you know, the money that you're saving in your money market fund or your savings account or your bank CDs or whatever have such a low interest rate that banks are paying on it. You know, it's nearly free money for them.
All right. Well... We don't have much time to be able to go into that too much more.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean. but the main point is that clearly it pays for people to be in debt. It doesn't pay for you to save money. Clearly, that's pretty much the way the economy is working right now. It's paying basically the way the system is set up is that the more people who are in debt, the better. The fewer people who save money, the better. And that's exactly the reverse of how it should be.
All right. That just leaves us a minute or so for international and Thailand.
Yeah, in Thailand, the government has offered elections in 9 months to the protesters. The protesters' demands were that the government should dissolve parliament and call elections in 30 days. They have made an offer that they will do this in 9 months instead. And some of the protesters in the street are amenable to this, and negotiations are going on right now. We'll see if that puts an end to the shutdown of the Bangkok business district that protesters have enforced for what has it been, like 3 months now? Something like that.
Months, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. And briefly, Iraq.
And in Iraq, Shiite groups have united to form a new government. This has totally sidelined the actual winners of the election. Ayat Alawi with his secular Sunni coalition, they have been completely shut out at this point. Now the question is, can the Shiite groups agree on who is going to be prime minister? And can they do it within the time frame allowed them before U.S. troops are going to start their withdrawal in August?
All right. And events. Any events?
Yeah, there's one event today at 10:30 a.m. at Seattle University in Bannon Room 102, the Socialism Conference. There'll be Cindy Sheehan will be one of the speakers
tonight.
Yeah, and Matt Gonzalez. He's the Green Party leader. Mm-hmm. So that's worth checking out if you get a chance. Starts at 10:30.
And a debate today between one of the prominent local Tea Party.
Yeah, this afternoon. This afternoon at the Socialism Conference, they're going to have a debate between a prominent Tea Party person and Rami Khalil.
From the Socialist Alternatives.
That could be very entertaining.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, places where you can find free publications. It can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org.